This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies,
but we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights
and get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that will stab the devil in the back. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
This is Kent, and I don't have a movie-related quote, but there was this thing I was reading the other day about debriefings go very smoothly. You're the sole survivor.
Hey, this is Chris, and I'll probably shit blood tonight.
In this episode, we're discussing The Usual Suspects, starring Gabriel Byrne, Kevin Pollak, Stephen Baldwin, Chaz Palminteri, Benicio Del Toro, Kevin Spacey, and directed by Bryan Singer. Gentlemen, we are talking about a movie that, just like Psycho before it, and even Seven to an extent, that has been spoiled like nobody's business.
Yeah.
Out of curiosity, when did you first see this film, and were you spoiled about the ending before seeing it?
Chris, you want to take this first?
I don't remember the first time I saw it. It was years ago, but it actually wasn't spoiled. I had a shirt, I think, from Threadless that, like, spoiled a bunch of movies, and the spoiler for Usual Suspects was on there. So I do remember seeing it afterwards, but luckily I dodged it because I'd already seen it. So
I think I've seen that shirt.
It's black, yeah, and it's got, like, Harry Potter, and, yeah,
like, Snape kills Dumbledore on it.
Right.
Rosebud was a sled. Yep. Kaiser Sose is Kevin.
Yeah. Well,
yes, okay.
You have anything to say, Kent?
The first time I actually saw this was for this podcast, but wow. Like years ago, like I'm thinking about 98 or 99 when, as you know from previous episodes, when I was doing the vampire arc thing, okay, I go embarrassed now, but there was somebody who went, oh, I'm going to design my character around Kaiser Sose and Usual Suspects and make everybody think this, like, okay, I have no point of reference here. And the guy just spoiled the whole thing.
Dick.
They're like, yeah, thanks. Well, you got to understand, a lot of LARPers, their character is the most important thing in the verse. Don't question anything else. Just go with that. And it's like, and then followed up by, what do you mean you've never seen it? It's like,
don't you just hate that? Those people that think that because they know the ending that everyone knows it.
Yeah.
It's... And the same person I've been in their face recently going, why aren't you watching what we do in the shadows? It's like, I don't know if that's... No, shut up, you and Usual Suspects. Go watch that movie. It is your penance to me.
Yeah. I can understand people not seeing what we do in the shadows. But that we've already talked about.
Yeah.
But we're going to talk about
We've talked about it. Go see as discussed in previous episodes. Yes, he ruined this movie.
I saw this movie. I actually wanted to see this in theaters, but I was 14 when this movie was made. So I had to.
Thanks for making me feel old.
Yeah. Okay. I had to wait until it hit video in order to see this. But as soon as it did, this was like as soon as it hit video, I grabbed it and watched it. And you have to understand that this was because of, I was told how amazing this story was. And because, if you don't remember last year when we talked about Seven, I loved that movie. And Kevin Spacey was a big part of that love for Seven. So I absolutely had to see this movie for Kevin Spacey, right? Mm-hmm. And when I saw the ending of this film, it made me smile and made me... I was just kind of like how I felt about Seven. Like, I was in on something that not many people are going to be in on just yet, but I knew was going to be big later, that I can talk about at a later point. It actually took me nearly 10 years to talk about this movie because, unfortunately, in places like Texas, these kinds of movies don't find an audience, you know, outside of, like, the uber film circles. And The Usual Suspects... It's just so damn good. It's like when I finally got a chance to talk about it, I think I probably bored everyone's ears by just going over this movie. The thing is that this is one of those movies, like, when I found Roger Ebert's online archive, one of the first movies I checked was, what did he think of The Usual Suspects? And it baffled me that he gave it a 1-star review. Like, what? Did we see the same movie? That was actually one of the things I really wanted to talk to about. You know, that and Fight Club, which he also gave a very negative review of. Those two movies, I never understood what he was thinking. But we will go ahead and talk about this movie in detail. And we are going to spoil the living shit out of this ending. In fact, we might just do it right off the bat just to get it out of the way. But there is a lot more to this movie than the ending, in my opinion. Go ahead and discuss that as well.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was agreeing that the movie isn't the ending. The movie is the lead up. So.
Out of curiosity, are you familiar with how the movie came to be?
Oh. Nope.
There's an origin story?
So Bryan Singer and Christopher McQuarrie were the originators of this movie. They came up with this idea based on a line from the movie that shall not be named, which is Round Up the Usual Suspects. Of course, it was said by my man Claude motherfucking Rains. So you know that's a line that I know very familiar, and that actually I actually saw this after the movie that shall not be named. I had seen it after I saw Usual Suspects. So when I saw that movie, it's like, now I know where that came from. And actually, Bryan Singer and Christopher McQuarrie did confirm that was the idea, and that they did have the idea of five criminals in a lineup, and they told the story around that. Now that's the first part of how this movie came to be. The second part was a chance encounter at a film festival that Bryan Singer had done a short film at that was Kevin Spacey attending it. Kevin Spacey loved that short film so much, he said to Bryan Singer, whatever you are going to do next, I want in on it. Just let me know what you want. And they built this character, Verbal Kent, around Kevin Spacey. And we'll be getting into that very shortly. But those two things, and especially with me, I love knowing the origins of story ideas. And it makes perfect sense. The image of five guys in a lineup. You have to understand that one of my favorite images in a Marvel movie is the lineup scene in Guardians of the Galaxy. So to me, that's just the image of five strangers in a room, not knowing who they are. And that actually is kind of the first image that we really have that's iconic in this movie. Now, we'll get into the things before we get to that image. But that's a pretty inspired image when you see the five guys being lined up against the lined wall, you know, and that first scene that they had together. But I guess before we get into that, what was coming into this movie, what were you expecting before you'd seen it for the first time? What did you know about this movie? And I guess I'm gonna start with Chris because you'd seen it before knowing the reveal.
I went into it blind, basically, which is the best way to go into a movie. I didn't know anything about it, so nothing was spoiled, and it was the effect that the movie. What am I trying to say here? Like the full effect of the movie actually like landed and didn't like get fucked up in any way. So that was nice. That's something that's pretty rare these days with the internet and asshole vampire LARPers turning about.
Asshole vampire LARPers. I think that needs to be its own podcast right there.
Right?
Yeah.
But what about you, Kent? Considering that you had gotten this spoiled before seeing the movie, what did you think this movie was going to be about?
I mean, I had it spoiled, but I wasn't sure what it was about. I knew it was... My assumption was it was cops trying to figure out which of these guys is the evil mastermind behind everything. So, and watching it, it turns out, wait, that's really kind of not what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's only really one interview, which meant after I watched it and saw the reveal, I'm like, okay, I need to get a... This is one of the few movies we've had that I've sat back and went, I have time. I'm I'd say rewind, but it's, you know, a DVD.
In my case, it was actually a rewind. I actually did have to rewind.
Yeah. Back in those days. But it was like, hit play again. Let's look around and see all the little clues that got missed the first time.
So let's talk about the structure of this film. And I have to admit, this is what I've mentioned, that the 24-hour film is one of my favorite structures. Another one of my favorite structures is the flashback movie, where we are getting, we know kind of the events that have occurred, and we're going back and we're revisiting. We know the outcome, but we don't know how we got there. You know, we talked about this with Memento. We talked about this with Citizen Kane. This is a little bit more like Citizen Kane than Memento, because in this movie, we have one person telling the story about how we got to a shipyard in California full of New York criminals that are dead. And that's not even the first thing, the first scene in the movie. I mean, the first scene that we have is the death of, you know, of Gabriel Byrne, you know, of this character, right? He, and this is kind of an interesting way to start a film, because especially as we find out with the reveal, there's something else going on here, and we don't really notice it, although it is kind of interesting to see a guy put out a flame fire with urine. I have to admit,
what?
Though,
he's never done that.
That's Deadshot right there. Okay, that's a superhero kind of aim. Tell me I'm wrong. Tell me I'm wrong about that. I mean, and it wasn't like he streamed it and like he swerved it to the right. No, he was dead on, like trajectory and everything.
You're saying, oh, wait a minute, I know why.
Why?
You guys are from Texas. You've never written your name in the snow.
Oh, so that's the kind of skill that it requires to...
I think it's the same skill set.
Huh.
It's where there's snow, and if he's from New York, he's probably done it when he was a kid. So he's got that aim.
I see.
Okay, that's a bizarre theory, but hey, it's workable, and it explains a few things.
Chris, are you buying this?
No.
I'm curious now.
You guys need
snow. You don't need any aim to, like, write your name in the snow. You can write your name any fucking where. You know,
I mean, we're talking about like Neil deGrasse Tyson levels of trajectory and physics in how to get that shot just right. Okay,
practice.
Yeah, just saying. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like Kaiser Soze just knows how to aim piss. Just saying.
Hey,
we'll get there. But okay, and it's important that we, the reason why it's important to talk about this scene as we get into the film is that this is one of the very few scenes that we can say for certain actually happened. Because we're going to find out a lot of the stuff that we're about to see, we don't know if it happened or not. Because we have ourselves a real unreliable narrator. And I have to admit, I love unreliable narrators because it adds an extra dimension. We don't know what's true and what's not true. And in this sense, they take it to the fullest extent. But yeah, I mean, that's our opener. We know that we don't know if certain people got killed. We're told that you know, people are dead. But we also know because of the day after, the bodies have been burned, right? So we don't know all of who's dead. We don't, or you know, exactly what the identities are just yet, because it takes time to do dental records, you know, the whole forensics thing. But we do have ourselves one. We have two survivors. One's in a coma. One is in police custody. And we're going to get this story from the one who's in police custody. And it starts off with an armored truck that has been jacked and five criminals brought into a lineup. Before we get to the lineup, though, what did y'all think about how we're introduced to these, how these five have been brought into custody? Because I have to admit, part of me kind of got a Dirty Dozen type vibe off this, you know, a kind of rough and tumble. Like, these guys are badasses, right? I mean, they don't have just a couple of cops come and bust them. They have, like, freaking police SWAT teams bringing these guys in, right?
hitting every single one of them. So yeah,
like even Kevin Pollak. It's like you don't need a freaking SWAT team for him. You know, they brought in the extra guns to bring him in. I mean, we're talking about Kevin freaking Pollak here. I'm sorry, but I don't see him being, you know, someone that'll like kill like five or six cops.
Well, better safe than sorry, especially if these guys are that bad. Bring him in.
Just saying. I mean, you know, and say what you will about Stephen Baldwin's acting, but I don't see him being bad in any other way. You know, he doesn't have the charisma of some of his other brothers. Even Billy, I think, is probably a bigger badass than Stephen. You know, and this was before he found Jesus. But, yeah, I will be talking about that. But I have to admit, though, it does kind of, you know, it does give us an interesting way of introducing these characters. Were there any that were specifically interesting to you that you find yourself kind of gravitating towards before we get to the lineup scene?
Actually, who's the mechanic?
That's Kevin Pollak. That's Hockney.
That's Pollak. Yeah. I just like how he's like, who's asking? Can you get out from underneath the car before we shoot you? Like, what?
Yeah, you have to understand. I love me some Kevin Pollak. He is a great comedian, and especially because just before this, he did A Few Good Men, where he was kind of, you know, Tom Cruise's smarmy, you know, sidekick character. So to see him kind of go from that to a sociopath, interesting choice to say the least. But what did y'all think about Benicio del Toro's entrance? You know, he's kind of got this kind of swagger to him. You know, he kind of comes off as a clown right from the beginning, right?
Yeah, especially with the way he talks.
Okay, let's go ahead and let's talk about the lineup. The lineup, this is the actors taking what was supposed to be a serious line, and they just ran with it. And I have to admit, okay, let's be honest here. This is the best acting Stephen Baldwin has ever done in his life. part of me doesn't even think it was Stephen Baldwin. I think it was Billy dressed up like Stephen.
With a mask.
I'm just saying, you know, they swap faces, you know, because this is the guy who's in Biodome, really?
Due for a remake of that, right?
Oh, God, don't you dare. Don't you dare say something. That is, no.
What?
No.
Okay.
Now I'm gonna have to burn parts of my brain that heard you say that. don't you ever say that. But seriously though, I mean, I love how, you know, they kind of are slapping each other. They're laughing. They're doing their goofiest renditions of this line, which is really a ridiculous line. it's fun and it's funny and it kind of just. You get the sense that they take it as a joke. The cops aren't really serious. And, of course, it really does kind of line up for the next scene, which is them in the jail cell. Or, no, it's not the jail cell because we get the individual, you know, grilling, right? We get all the different characters being grilled. So, in kind of how they take this. Now, one thing I will say before is that it also introduces Dave Kuyan, because Kuyan is the one who busts Keaton, right? He's the one who grabs him from the restaurant. And of course, he'll be the one that'll be interrogating Verbal in the interrogation scene, right? So, I guess the first question I'm going to have to ask is, how is customs involved in this hijacking, and how is it also involved in this ship? You know, why is it that Kuyan is involved in both of these?
That's what keeps jumping back. It's kind of the back and forth fuses me at first. So
yeah,
unless there's something in that truck that was recently brought in. But
well, okay,
it's
so
supposed to just be cash.
Hold on. The thing is as we find out later from Kobayashi.
Yeah,
it wasn't Keaton who was involved in the truck. It was Hockney. Hockney was the one who stole the truck.
Okay,
so we know that for a fact. Or I guess fact-ish, let's put it that way. Because, like I said, a lot of this stuff, we are not going to know if it's true or not. And that's one of the things about this movie that's going to be both very frustrating and very fascinating at the same time, at least for me. We'll discuss if that's the same way for both of you. But why is Kuyon involved? And this is one of those questions, even when I saw it for the first time, it's like, you know, because I Customs, if I'm not correct, they call him Special Agent Kuyon, but unless there's a tie, and it doesn't seem like there's a tie, it seems just like he's just going after Keaton. Like, he's just going after Keaton for everything, but Keaton was a dirty cop. From nothing that we show says that he was involved in any kind of, like, customs thing. I mean, you know, was there any kind of indication maybe that I've missed about, you know, Keaton being involved in some sort of customs ring? Because if it was a customs ring, it wouldn't be that they would, you know, that he would do a little time in jail. If it's that kind of felony, we're talking about like 10, 15 years.
Well, he was the cop taxi service.
No, he wasn't a part. He wasn't a part of New York's finest taxi service. He knows about it.
What is he corrupt for?
We don't know.
Well, if he knew about it, he might know about anything else that came in. But that's also. Maybe he just feels that's the weak spot where he could get in. Pump him for information, get it, and move on. But
okay, well, bear in mind, though, here, another interesting factor in all this is that when they do kind of, when they do the heist and they have to take it to California, they aren't using Keaton's contact. Keaton is the outsider.
No.
You know, if I'm not correct, they're using McManus. It was McManus's guy that they're using. And if he's involved in customs, then he would have his own fences, you know.
True.
So, or people that he knows, or you know, if he's been in those circles, they know of who Keaton is because, you know, a cop who, you know, a former cop who was involved in major racketeering, or not racketeering, but major import export type stuff. That's
smuggling.
Yeah, they would know about this guy, and yet they don't. Now, bear in mind that this is part of that fact-ish, and I think we should go ahead and distinguish. There are things that are facts, and there are things that are fact-ish that we don't know for fact that they actually happen. So we have to kind of keep those in perspective as we talk about this. So, but Kuyon, you know, I don't know. The thing is that Kuyon doesn't question this, though, which is also kind of interesting. Now, this could just be bad storytelling or bad screenwriting. Now, it also should be said that this is a movie that won an Academy Award for its screenwriting. Now, that doesn't mean a whole lot because there have been other movies that have won Academy Awards for screenwriting that didn't deserve it. La La Land. Did I say something? But that said, though, I mean, I don't know. What do y'all think about all this? Did y'all have any questions about some of the story before getting into the reveal, or after you saw the reveal that you kind of find yourself kind of questioning why certain things happened the way they did, and why Kuyon didn't kind of press Furble on certain inconsistencies?
I think Furble was just doing a good job weaving a story. He didn't notice some of the inconsistencies, or he just felt. Or Verbal was able to get across that. Oh, I don't understand why this happened, because look at me. I'm really just a simple guy. I just kind of this and this, and I was there, but I didn't understand this, so don't ask me.
Oh, actually I have an easier idea. And this is something that I was thinking about this time around when I saw it for this movie. Because I did, like I said, I was kind of wondering, like, why didn't he press this? Why didn't he press that? But I'm kind of curious to see if maybe Chris, if he has any ideas, or if there are any questions that he had.
I didn't really have any questions, and I actually watched this movie twice, which I don't usually get to do, and none of these questions came up, so I feel kind of bad about that.
All right, so let's reveal the big one. So, spoiler, if you haven't seen this, what the fuck are you watching this for or listening to this for? All right, so Verbal Kent is the mastermind behind this all.
What?
He is Kaiser Soze. Oh, right. He is the man behind the mask. Mm. Here's the thing. His whole plan of getting out of this rests entirely on Agent Kuyon coming involved. Because Kuyon wanted it to be Keaton. he wanted it so bad that he wanted that everything that all of his questions are leading towards is Keaton. He wants Verbal to affirm his suspicion. So he isn't thinking outside that because he doesn't see anyone but Keaton being the one responsible for everything. If Kuyan didn't get involved, Verbal or Kaiser wouldn't have gotten away. Or if he did, it would have been a massive shootout that John Woo would have been gushing over. The blood and violence that would have been involved to get him out would have been glorious. But no, the whole point of him being able to sneak away rests entirely on Kuyan. And the fact that he does what he does with playing with him, with all the stuff from the boards and this cup, that is the biggest middle finger. Because he not only played him, he played him beyond played him. He basically bent him over and did things to his body that would probably shame certain
people. But he played him in his home field using his own environment against him. Let me use these bits off the wall right behind you.
But you also have to understand that the story that he told also had, because he had to find a way to keep Keaton as a suspect.
Yeah.
The thing is that Kuyan, if Kuyan stopped believing that Keaton was involved, and understand that it would have taken basically like definitive evidence, like, you know, Keaton, like basically, you know, evidence that Keaton never did anything wrong, which would never have occurred. But no, he had to keep Kuyan believing that Keaton was involved. So he made sure that he didn't leave room for Keaton to be entirely faultless. But he also had to make sure that he was defending Keaton to keep Kuyan from being suspicious. So there's like three or four layers of what Verbal is doing in these scenes, which again talks about what Spacey's doing with his performance. And that's the beautiful thing about what Spacey's doing here. Because as it also turns out, Kevin Spacey was the only one who knew the truth. Everyone else didn't know what the ending was.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Even Chaz Palminteri didn't know. In fact, if I'm not correct, Chaz Palminteri believed that he was Kaiser Soze. Yeah. It was one of those things that Bryan Singer made sure that no one knew but Kevin Spacey. And it's because Kevin Spacey had to do the ending, right? You know, he had to do the final, the finale. So what Kevin Spacey is doing here is that he's not just playing it on two different levels of, well, I know who I am and what I'm trying to get across, but he's also trying to outthink another character, right? Because it's really a sparring match between Kuyan and Kaiser. And the thing is Kaiser can't win outright. He has to make Kuyan think he won in order to get away. But he also has decided because, you know, that this is his chance to really mess with him. You know, because like he says, after this, he disappears. You know, he's not coming back. It doesn't matter what happens after he walks out. And even if he didn't walk out, like I said, they would have gotten him out. It would have been bloodshed, but he would have gotten out. But yeah, I mean, so then the question becomes, what of that story was even true? And that's where the fun of this story gets involved, because the thing is that like a lot of people that have said things negatively, and including Roger Ebert, says, well, since the endings, the person who's telling us the story basically made up everything. No, he didn't, because there are things.
He had to leave parts true.
Well, yeah, but the thing is that he weaves in events that he can't fabricate. That would have been too easy to corroborate. The lineup had to happen. Remember, Kuyan was the guy who brought in Keaton. He was the one who, so he knows that the lineup occurred. He knows that he arrested him. He also, the events like the New York Finest being attacked, you can't make that up because that made news. You know, that's a big event. If he made that up and they bought that without any correlation, that says a lot about, says a lot more about how awful this police force is. If he could basically make up a whole story about, you know, corrupt cops being taken down, you know, in a massive sting, and they didn't realize that or they didn't check, I mean, that would be like balls. I mean, serious balls to make something like that up. So that had to have happened, because Kaiser wouldn't have risked that much on something that easy to verify. You know, the events that are small in nature, you know, the things that you know, that wouldn't have left bodies, you know, like the pier. A lot, you know, you can't hide the fact that the pier occurred. You know, that there are gunshots, there are bullets, there are flames. You know, there's wreckage. You know, you have a dead drug dealer, you know, that was found in a parking lot. You can't deny that that didn't happen. You know, that did happen. These events are, so he has to tell events that actually occurred with fabrication. And that's where the fabrications come in, and exactly what is true, what is not true, because he has to be able to put all these guys on that boat, right?
He can look up some of these events too. He didn't have to be involved technically any of them.
Well, that's true.
If he knew something happened, he could read the same police reports, or not police reports, but media reports, and even just one of them could have been involved and said something to him. It's like, oh, tell me this story. Okay. When I retell it, we're all there.
So basically, what you're saying is that, and this is true. I mean, I have to grant you this. It could be that just that Kaiser decided to kidnap four criminals, force them on a boat, burn them, because, again, there's going to be records of who these guys are, and basically just make up a story. Why do that? I mean, that would be more ludicrous than, you know, making up everything. I mean, he has New York criminals on a boat in California, and he was a part of the lineup, you know? So that's the thing, is that, you know, the fact that he was in that lineup as well sets up there's a reason why he got these guys there. You know, as Keaton basically said in the jail cell, you don't put five criminals in the same lineup. You put one in and you put in some decoys.
Yeah.
You know, so this was a setup from the beginning. And that's the thing about this is that Kuyon would have, again, if he didn't have such a hard on for Keaton, he would have realized that. So, or, you know, maybe, again, it could be just bad screenwriting. But I don't know, part of me just doesn't feel like that. I feel like there was more involved. Maybe that's just me wanting that to be the case. I'll admit it, I have a blind spot for this movie. And there are some serious problems with the structure. But again, it's one of those things that you could probably make an excuse for all of the problems, because there's enough room there that you can make those leaps. Right. I mean, and it's really in the performances. I mean, were there any performances that you felt didn't work? Now, bear in mind, we do have a few Academy Award winners and Academy nominees in this lineup. So, not to mention the great Stephen Baldwin,
one and only,
who I thought did good. So,
oh no, he was good in this.
I've heard you slam on him before, and I was paying attention to him in this, going, maybe this is the highlight of his career? I don't know.
Let me put it this way. Yeah. It goes so downhill from here that I don't think he really wants to be religious, because that slope goes way further down than he really hopes. We haven't even talked about Mr. Murder. that's online. Yeah.
Anyway. Ooh, excuse me.
But seriously though, were there any performances here that just didn't work?
I couldn't think of Chris.
I don't know. I was looking through the cast trying to think of somebody, and like, I don't know. I was gonna say, I mean, Pete Postlethwaite's accent, but even he, like,
Kobayashi?
Even he does a pretty good job with that. So, like, that's the only thing I'd, like, maybe nitpick. Otherwise,
I was gonna say Clark Gregg, because not once does he reference S.H.I.E.L.D., but no, I'm just kidding. He looks young in this, but as the doctor who initially we encounter, but mm-hmm. yeah.
All right, so let's we'll be getting the geek sheet because this thing's got a geek sheet on it, like it's nobody's business.
That's a nice geek sheet.
Oh baby, this is a Dreamcast kind of geek sheet we got here. But again, there's a lot of moving parts that are going on here because not only do we have the interrogation and the backstory, but we also have the burned gangster in the coma. Who is being interrogated by Giancarlo Esposito. And this is the first time I've seen him in a film. After this, I would see Do the Right Thing, and my love for him becomes complete by that point. We'll obviously be talking more about him in Geek Sheet, but what do you think about this? In my opinion, this is the clock, right? Because as soon as this guy wakes up, as soon as this guy fingers Kaiser Soze, that's the game, right?
Right. Because he's seen him.
Yeah. So that is the place where the entire story is kind of is moving at this rate. As soon as this information is revealed, that's game over. That's, you know, the pieces will be revealed at that point. But I also love the fact that it's him screaming Kaiser Soze that enters Kaiser Soze into this conversation. And I especially love how Kevin Spacey handles this. Because as soon as Kuyan comes back with "Who's Kaiser Soze?", what's his response? It's "Aw, fuck."
Yeah.
Because here he is thinking, especially since we know that he's Kaiser, he's thinking that there's a chance that no one's going to know that Kaiser was even involved, and now his name is out there, and it's only going to be a matter of time. So what does he do? He plays himself up to be the greatest villain of all time.
Yeah.
I mean, I especially love that when he talks about, you know, the Kaiser becomes the little ghost story that gangsters tell their little kids, you know, don't you rat out on your dad or Kaiser says it will get you. Look at how Kuyan responds to that. He actually smiles at this story. He kind of likes this story a little bit, right?
Looks that way.
And think to yourself.
An off-the-wall story.
And just remember, Chaz Palminteri thinks he's Kaiser Soze.
Yeah.
See, so it takes on a different level there. But in a way, though, can we say that perhaps Kuyan, in his own way, is kind of like Kaiser Soze? I mean, look at kind of how determined he was to go after Keaton. I mean, he's breaking rules left and right in order to get this guy, right? I mean, he basically threatens verbal, like, you know, about what he's going to, you know, he's going to put his name out in a, you know, in the pen and, you know, and he's going to put the word out on verbal Kent. Now, remember, again, that especially since we know that he's Kaiser, how anonymity means a lot to him, right? So even if his alter ego is tarnished, how would he respond to that?
Kidding.
Layers. Lots of layers. Yeah. That's what I love about this movie. But, oh man. Did y'all have any places in the movie where y'all just kind of like, what the fuck? Or, you know, kind of like, did you get lost at any point in the movie? Or do you think that you pretty much know everything that's going on? Or where did this movie kind of fall in the spectrum of understandability?
There were a few parts during the shootout that I was getting confused over who was shooting who, why, and...
Actually, believe it or not, the shootout actually was one of the... That was pretty easy to determine because we had... So Finster was at the truck. We had McManus, who is basically the point man. So McManus was the brawler. He was the one who was going up the front. You have Keaton, that's the point man, right? He's the one that's calling the shots. Verbal is kind of the cleanup, is kind of how they put it. Finster's already dead, so he's not involved in this, right? And so McManus is the one that's going in guns blazing. Keaton kind of, he sneaks onto the ship, if I'm not correct. Or maybe it was McManus that sneaks on the ship. It was...
Two of them get on board and start shooting.
Well, no, it's Keaton and McManus that get on the ship Kevin Pollack, he was the one that's at the truck because he gets stabbed in the back. Oh, no, it was McManus that gets stabbed in the back. Kevin Pollack gets the blinding light. You know, he turns around and...
Yeah. gets shot. Yeah.
Was it shot? Yes, maybe it was
shot. At the truck where he opened. Well, he's the one who opens up the back of the van.
Yeah, right? He opens the back of the van. Finds he turns all the around. Cash.
Yeah. And gets. I thought he got shot.
But he got shot first and then the light, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, he turns around and he's like, he realizes and then night night.
Yeah.
So it's like he has that revelation as like he knows who shot him, which of course would be because we already know about Kaiser. Kaiser's the one who did it, right? So.
Well, in Kaiser's story, Kaiser.
In Kaiser's story.
In verbal story, Kaiser Sose is the one who shot him.
Now, here's the thing though. Technically speaking, Verbal either saw the event and he's telling
right.
Kuyan about it. And of course, Kuyan is completely ignoring the fact that it seems like Verbal knows how all of these guys died.
Yeah.
Or Kuyan has, that we're seeing Kuyan's interpretation of the events that Verbal is telling him, and he's imagining this himself. In that case, how did he know about the cash in the van? Because that wasn't there. Because the whole point was that this was supposed to be a drug deal. And there, but the fact was there were no drugs. It was, in fact, an informant that was on this
right.
that was on this ship, right?
The day, okay, so did. That confused me about the money, because there was a lot of money, but none of it moved. Was it still there when the cops show up?
All right, so...
Because I don't think Verbal does anything.
Yeah. Okay, so technically speaking, the reason why the money was there was because this informant knows who Kaiser Soze is.
Right.
The one, because of this information is so important in the underground, that they were trading this guy out for cash. Kaiser finds out about this. And uses this ragtag group of his Dirty Dozen, his Suicide Squad, to come in and kill the informant. Now, the way because Kaiser does things inadvertently, he tells them that there's drugs in order to get compliance. Now, this is coming off of Kaiser's story. He tells them that they're drugs so that they are compliant. They don't realize what they're doing is they're basically a hit squad because
right.
if they were told they were a hit squad, they wouldn't go along with it. That said, though, considering that Kaiser has the goods on these guys, even if he told them that it was a hit, or it's not as though they were going to run away. I mean, considering the reach that Kaiser has, right? But maybe it's just kind of so that, you know, because maybe he saw that these guys can freaking pull off a Mission Impossible style hit on, you know, on his operation. Because they get really damn close to Kobayashi, right?
They don't even have to... do the hit. They just need to take everything out around the target.
Mm-hmm.
And then either as Verbal or as Kaiser, he can finish the job.
Well, basically, Kaiser just basically pulled a Joker. You know, he gets his guys to do it, then he kills his guys and kills the informant and walks away, right?
That'd be the second to no one trilogy being Joker. Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about Dark Knight here.
Yes. Exact version of characters, but yes, that's... That is what he does, so...
And considering that we know that Kobayashi is a real person, because he's the one who picks up Kaiser from the police station when they let him go, right? So we know that he is real. We know that the informant was there because of what... because of the other survivor says, right? Because he tells Giancarlo Esposito, what was going down on that ship, right?
Yeah. As the ever so survivor. This is what happened. Kaiser Soze was there. I'm going to go comatose now. What?
Oh, no. He was burned. I mean, he was left for dead. You know,
yeah.
That's the one thing. That was Kaiser's big failure. He thought that he killed everybody, and he left one person alive. One person that knew what he looks like. So that's... And the thing is that even as he walks... I guess by the he knows because they say his name, so he knows that someone survived. But outside of that, he doesn't know who survived. Mm. But I have a strange feeling they are not going to live to see the night. Just saying, especially if he still has that kind of reach.
Well, the thing is, he drew a sketch and gave it to the cops, so more people now know.
Well, yes.
So,
but the thing is, though, is considering that Kaiser, for the most part, this was him disappearing, right?
Yeah.
Well, I guess at this point, because his face is pretty much now recognized, because now there is Verbal confirmation, or, you know, visual confirmation of Kaiser Soze. It's not as the every police force in the world now knows what Kaiser Soze looks like. And in fact, if this police station has video surveillance, which would be the case in 95, in that case, Kaiser failed at the end. I mean, it was kind of one of those things like, I got out of police custody, but now everybody knows what I look like.
Time to go to my Swiss bank accounts and go into retirement.
Yeah. So maybe that would, So
and I mean, if the original idea was just Kobayashi only telling various underworld sources what he looked like, well, that doesn't work anymore. His revenge for almost getting killed is, nope, here's law enforcement knowing what you look like. Underworld will know within a day, so...
Well, I mean, yeah, he could still pull a Mission Impossible and just kind of disappear, but the thing is that he won't be able to pull off anything without people knowing that he's out there. So, in a way, I guess you could say that he lost in the end, that the main goal that he was going for kind of backfired, but it's one of those things, it's kind of one of the beautiful things about the movie that you can kind of look at when you look at all the different angles, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, so I guess at this particular point, what do you think about Agent Kuyon in this movie? What were your impressions about what he stood for in the movie?
About who?
Yeah, Chaz Palminteri.
Yeah, about just what he stands for, just getting to the bottom of this.
Okay, well, the thing is that in regards to the story, he's the one who's bucking against Verbal's story, right? He's the one who's like saying, it wasn't exactly what you said it was. But he's also the guy who's listening to the story at the same time, right? With the exception of Dan Hedaya, who is it just me? And that character doesn't seem like he really needs to be, other than the fact that just for legal jargon, like, like you could have had him completely removed from it. And the only reason he's there is basically just to give some jurisdiction and maybe give give Chaz Palminteri someone to talk to when he isn't talking to Verbal, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and you need another guy in it, so.
Well, no. I mean, Dan Hedaya never talks to Verbal. He only talks to Kuyon. You know, that's the only person he ever talks to.
Right. But he's in the room the whole time.
No, actually, he's looking from the one-way glass.
Okay.
I mean, he goes into the room, a couple of times. But
okay.
For the most part, though, he's watching it from the one-way glass. Wait, no. Was he even in the one-way glass? I'm sorry.
He was listening to it on a...
Yeah, he was
listening. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, it's like, this is one of those movies, like...
You're talking yourself out of it because of logic. It's like, here's my logic. This is a heist film or a murder film.
But that's the thing, is like, it's not really even a heist film.
Yes.
The thing is that when I think about this movie, I also think about a movie called Rashomon, done by the great Akira Kurosawa, which is also a movie about an event that is being told by unreliable narrators. And in that instance, it's three different stories about what happened in this one particular event. And I love both of these movies for the same reasons, because it never answers truly what really happened. We get one story of it, and from that one story, we can figure out the things that happened, things that might not have happened, what makes the most sense. And, you know, kind of, it's a play on both objectivity and subjectivity of what you bring into a film, what the film brings to itself. And that's in my opinion, what this movie really is. It's an exercise of sorts, you know, because, like, as I mentioned before, only the director, the writer, and the actor knew the entire story. Everyone else thought they had something completely different. And the way that they weave these together to tell the story that they do leaves the audience really truly wondering what is real, what really happened. And that was the intended effect. It was meant to be that way. We're not supposed to find out what really happened. And those people who say that all of it is lies, technically that's incorrect. But in a way, that's what the filmmakers wanted you to come away thinking. They wanted you to have that complete doubt about what it is that you saw, because that's the whole point, is it's wanting you to come to your own conclusion as to what really happened. Give you enough that it's not entirely full of shit, but at the same time, put enough shit in it that you're kind of weeding through the little nuggets. Maybe that's more graphic than you really want it to be, but in a way, that's really what it's going for. Or at least that's kind of where I'm getting from. Are y'all getting a different vibe from it?
That you're going to have to watch the vibe that asks, how many times do you have to watch this and get out your own notes on the wall with string to figure out what is true and what is not true?
Actually, I guess the real question is, does it matter what's true and what isn't true? Mm. What is it that verbal is telling a story basically to appease one character? He's toying with one character. That's the story here, is this guy is messing with another guy. That's what it breaks down to. It doesn't really matter what it is, what he's telling is true or not. It's basically you're watching a guy troll another guy. And at the very end, you realize that he got trolled bad. Right?
Yeah.
And I get, and what the film is doing with this, and that's the beautiful thing about what this film does. And that's every time that I have to, whenever I talk to a skeptic of the film or someone that, you know, that just shits on the film, this is kind of my retort. And if you think that it's full of shit, you're probably right. Maybe it is full of shit, but this is what I take away from it. And that's why I think that this movie's a freaking genius. Maybe not as a piece of great storytelling in the sense, but as an exercise in storytelling. Definitely. You know, it is kind of a means of messing with the audience, getting them to think about what it's important, how story is important to them in a way. And maybe I'm just really over explaining this, so. Anyway, I guess the question comes for the question that comes next is, now that you know, after you've seen you get the final reveal, does this movie take a different vibe for you? Do you find yourself enthralled by this movie? Or is this a one-note thing where, okay, now I've seen it, I don't need to see it again. It's one and done.
Well, I did do that second viewing just to go, okay, how? And you can actually watch Verbal read the wall and assemble his story based on what's behind there. And that's really
What is he doing the first time? The first time that Kuyan comes into the room, he's looking at the wall.
Yeah, he's studying it. I mean, every little bit from that. It's like,
also, it should be noted that when he tells the story about the lineup, he isn't in the room with the wall. So right. Just remember that he's in an interrogation room when he tells that story.
But he doesn't. I don't think he needs any
because
details.
Because Kuyan doesn't show up until after he tells about the lineup. See, that's another one of the things about the film, is that you also have to line up the events that take place in the order that it takes place, because that also matters.
I wonder if there's a rat somewhere.
No. I don't, this is a movie, if they ever do make it like a director's cut, or if there's like added scenes, I don't want to see it, unless it obfuscates even more. I don't want to know what really happened, because that's not the point of the movie. You know, again, I'm going back to Rashomon. Rashomon was all about making the audience uncertain about what really happened. That was the whole point of that. And this movie does that exact same thing, in my opinion. But I guess now that we've kind of... What about you, Chris? Is this a movie that you would be coming back to? Or that you find yourself still enthralled with? Or is this kind of like, okay, I'm done. I don't need to see it.
I'm actually somewhere in the middle. Like, I don't think... I couldn't watch it, like, regularly. I could do it, like, every couple years, probably. Because, like, I'm bad about rewatching movies anyway. But especially if there's, like, a big twist or something, and you go into it and you already know it, especially, like, when I'm concerned, it's just, like, part of me is, like, I already know how it ends. I don't need to see it. Blah, blah, blah. You know? But, like, at the same time, when you're finally watching it, you're like, oh, I didn't notice that before. So that's kind of cool. You know, that kind of shit. So, I mean... Yes and no is the short answer. So, yeah.
So I guess at this point, let's go ahead and let's break it. Let's just break down the legacy of this film, because this has become a cult classic. This is a movie that has a pretty hardcore fan base. Bryan Singer makes the Usual Suspects his logo. You know, his Bad Hat Harry logo is the five guys in the lineup. You know, this movie did win a couple of Oscars. You know, Best Original Screenplay. Kevin Spacey won for Best Supporting Actor. Did this movie deserve that, in your opinion? Whether or not you think it's good or not, do you think that this is a movie that earned its cult status?
Well, let's see what's against that, because it's always about what it's up against.
In 1995, that was the year of... Braveheart.
Yeah. search. Okay, best actor in a supporting role. Up against Cromwell and Babe, Harrison, team, Brad Pitt and 12 Monkeys.
Yeah.
Tim Roth and Rory. Ooh. That looks like a tough crowd to be up against, anyway.
That is true.
But at the same time, though, this might have been one of those popularity things, because 12 Monkeys, technically science fiction, I could see it not succeeding.
Whenever we talk about 12 Monkeys, and we will talk about 12 Monkeys, we'll be talking about Brad Pitt's performance, because in my opinion, if they would have ever split an award before, this would have been it between Kevin Spacey and Brad Pitt.
Babe always kind of struck me as a quote-unquote kids movie, so I'd see him, Cromwell, not win. So that really meant...
I never understood why Cromwell got nominated, I'll be honest. I really don't.
And,
weird.
Yeah, and that leaves Spacey up against Ed Harris and Tim Roth, so I could see him winning that.
I'll be honest here.
I don't know if he deserved it against
In 1996, I honestly loved Ed Harris's performance. I really wanted him to win. And it wouldn't be the first or the last time that I felt that way about Ed Harris. But now, thinking about it, it's a great performance, but it's pale in comparison to Brad Pitt and Kevin Spacey. I mean, it's not even on the same level because both of those. Both of those films, and not trying to get too much into 12 Monkeys because that's not the movie we're talking about this time, and I have a feeling I'm going to have a lot to say about that movie when we get to it. But what Brad Pitt does in that film is, it's the same way as what Kevin Spacey does in this, because there's what we think we know, and there's what is the reality of this character. And when you get, the only thing that's different between those is that we get to know what is really the deal about Brad Pitt's character, and we don't with Kevin Spacey. That would be the only thing that kind of changed that dynamic. But the thing is, though, if you're just looking at it from the performance-wise, both of them have that same kind of mischievous, that same kind of mystery, that same kind of not really sure exactly what to think about, and they play a wild card. And in both instances, you're not even sure as to what they're wild card of, you know, because the movie doesn't look like it's really about them. It's really about something else. And then it turns out that it's really about them.
Yeah. Okay. And then for screenplay, Usual Suspects won. The other nominees were Braveheart, Mighty Aphrodite, Nixon, and Toy Story.
Yeah, they picked right.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
really? Up against Toy Story? Come on.
I mean, that would have given Joss Whedon his win, but no.
But again, it's kids animated. They're not going to get.
No, it's because it's too simple. It's a simple story. I mean, it's been done, you know, more or less by other kids' films. I mean, it's basically, you know, two brothers that are fighting for attention of a parent, except this time it's two toys fighting over the attention of a child. I mean, really, that's really what it is. And we see other films that do that. Sorry, Pixar. It's not that original. Again, I have a strange feeling we'll be talking about Toy Story at some point. Just give it a few more years. But... what about you, Chris? Where do you come down on all this?
On which part of it?
On either the best supporting actor or best original screenplay.
Oh. I do think it deserved the screenplay, because nothing else around that time period had this kind of writing. So, like, I do feel like, you know, like, introducing something that's unique and fresh deserves some sort of accolade. So, I mean, that's awesome. And... you know, I think Kevin Spacey's great in this, so I would, although I do really like 12 Monkeys as well, so that's a tough call, but I do think they did pick the right person to win the award, just by a stretch.
Would you have called it a tie for Best Supporting Actor if it came down to Brad Pitt and Kevin Spacey?
I'd still give the nod to Spacey, just like by a hair, though. It's very close.
I get you.
Yeah.
All right, so at this point, is there anything else that we really want to talk about this film? Because I think we've kind of covered the major bases, and it's one of those types of movies, like, we could go into the smaller details, but it really just it's really more subjective more than objective. It's really what you think about it more than it is about what we're really talking about, or at least that's kind of how I feel. But what about y'all? Do y'all have anything else you want to bring up about this?
Like I said, debriefings go smooth when you're the sole survivor, so nobody could contradict him.
I'll accept the facts.
Well,
and in this case, it actually meant FAX because of what they
said. Oh, yeah. Well, he just, you could also look at it as maybe he thinks of Kaiser Soze as a completely different individual who just inherits his body. So, split personality-ish thing.
What about you, Chris? Anything?
I don't have anything else. I think we covered everything.
All right, Kent, start us off with the geek sheet.
Oh, man.
quickly, back to the IMDb.
Really? You need the IMDb for this one?
Well, for some of the very esoteric stuff in here, like, there's somebody I just saw did a voice for Transformers. It gets really bizarre at times. So, I mean, we mentioned Greg Clark from...
Clark Gregg?
Clark Gregg.
Because Greg Clark is Gregg. A different guy altogether.
Yeah, okay. Well, he has two first names. I get very confused.
You also do that with Tom David Clark. Keith and Keith David?
Yes. Don't ask.
Oh, wow.
Damn these people with two first names. But yeah, from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Let's see. Let's insult Stephen Baldwin and see what he's been in. He was in Flintstones. So we'll just back out of that.
Yeah, walk backwards.
Yeah.
Slowly.
Del Toro's been in.
Really? You need to go to IMDb for Del Toro?
Sometimes I do. Well, I don't recognize him under that makeup of the collector. Yes.
He's going to be in Star Wars.
Yep.
Not to mention that he won an Academy Award for Traffic. In my opinion, he should have won a second one for Sicario, but, you know, the Academy is just a bunch of idiots.
Just a bunch of idiots? More than a bunch of idiots, so... Oh.
Don't get me started. Not until Oscar season, then you can hear my rant.
Get me started. Remember, on this year's Oscar rant, I mean special. Let's see. Wow. Esposito was a singer on the original Electric Company?
Ooh. Seriously, are you not going to address the giant skull in the room?
What, his time on Once Upon a Time is the Magic Mirror?
No. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh.
Gus motherfucking Fring, motherfucker. Come on, dude. Come on.
Sometimes
you did Breaking Bad. You know you did Breaking Bad.
Actually, I didn't do Breaking Bad.
Blasphemy.
Hey, we don't have cable.
It's on Netflix.
Well, now it is.
No, it's been on there for years.
It goes back to our pre-recording conversation about which shows I still need to watch. So
this is like tonight's binge.
I have to go to bed.
I expect your full report in the morning. I'm kidding.
Yes, 24. What? How many seasons did that go?
Five.
Five, so times 24. Yes.
No, not 24. Not 24. It was it's like most were like 8 to 10 episodes a season.
Okay, so
you don't have that excuse. 50
episodes before in 6 hours, I could do it.
First season's only like 6 episodes, man. It's not bad.
Oh,
okay. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, come on, hand it. You got a lot more to go. Come on.
Oh, come on. There's too much. I mean, all I'm right. looking
so
at.
So is it my turn then?
Dan Heydalia being in Commando and the Addams Family.
Yes, he was.
Yes. So. You take it from here, so right, I need a drink.
All right, so Gabriel Byrne actually played the devil against Arnold Schwarzenegger in End of Days. Mm-hmm. We have Bryan Singer, who directed a little, superhero series called Superman Returns. Just kidding. Sorry, I had to bring that up. But no, X-Men. X-Men.
I thought you were going to say X-Men. Jack the Giant Slayer, so.
That's not a superhero.
It's close enough.
No,
not even it's medieval close. Superhero. But, yeah,
Christopher McQuarrie. You know, he made his name with Jack Reacher, or as I call it, NCIS Tom Cruise, and then handled Mission Impossible: Rogue Nation. And I believe he's directing the new Mission Impossible movie, which is coming out next year. Kevin Spacey's done absolutely nothing.
Except win Oscars.
When Oscars, changed the game. Was in a little, a little movie earlier this year called Baby Driver. Maybe you've seen it, maybe you haven't.
Is my president.
Very few people
saw it.
Under the radar, completely. But if you want a sci-fi, though, he was Lex Luthor in said Superman Returns movie.
Best part of the movie.
Also,
best part of the movie.
He was also the AI in a little indie film that Moon. We might talk about at some point called Moon.
Yes.
I want to talk about that, yeah.
We will eventually get to that at some point. But of course, nothing will ever be any, you know, that will be, will rival his performance as the Hollywood version of Dr. Evil in Austin Powers Goldmember. Just saying, there's nothing.
That's the only one I haven't seen. I think we own the other two, but I haven't seen
You're not really missing all that much, so.
I didn't.
And I believe that we will be talking about Mr. Spacey at some point later in the year, because there's another movie that came out about 20 years ago that, yeah, we gotta talk about. And I believe that's it for now. I don't want to go into the others because that would take us forever at this point. But yes, this movie made a lot of careers, and those are just a few of them. But are you ready to call it, gentlemen?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah.
Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics and the massive amounts of audience members who love this movie on The Usual Suspects? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Chris?
Pass. I mean, I feel like I pretty much already said why I enjoyed it. But, you know, I don't think I can revisit it as much as most people do. But it still holds up. Still really well done. Kevin Spacey's amazing. The twist is like one of the most talked about ones I hear about in film. So, I mean, it's still relevant after, you know, 22 years. That's right, right? Right, Math?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
But yeah, so pass.
Kent?
I'm going to say this is a pass as well. I would actually like to recommend it to somebody and then sit down beside them as they watch it. And then at the same time as they're watching it for the first time, I'd be on my third time going, okay, we get off the notebook, yes, okay, ah, I understand this part now completely, okay. I go, aha, and figure out exactly what is true, what is not true, and what is a half-truth. So, anyway.
I will say, when it comes to The Usual Suspects, I this is one of those movies, like, if I come to a person that says that this is the greatest movie of all time, I would say you're right. If you said this is a complete piece of shit and is not worthy of the celluloid that's printed on, I would say you're right as well, because this is a movie that completely questions objectivity and subjectivity in a way that I don't think any film truly ever has. You know, we talked about 2001 just last week, and I think that especially watching this after watching 2001, and seeing kind of the response that people had to 2001, how they were putting themselves in what they thought was in that film, I can kind of understand why they did so. The problem is that the movie doesn't give you enough information in order to kind of correlate, you know, truth and fiction. Where this one does, it has definitive information that you can go off of to lead you to the different approaches. And maybe I'm being a complete hypocrite here, and I will totally accept that if someone says that about me. But the thing is that this film does give you those areas. You can say, and I would agree with you, that most of what happened in this movie didn't happen. And even the stuff that I would say did happen, you could probably make a case that it didn't happen, because we did have a dead shot with a piss, all right? So, you know, reality in this movie is flexible, to say the very least. At the same time, though, I could just watch this, and I just love the performances. I love the acting. Kevin Spacey is so awesome in this. But it's not just Kevin Spacey. Benicio del Toro is Finster. He has, like, what, three scenes? And all of them are awesome. I mean, you know, that flip it for real. I mean, he just kills it. I mean, he just makes himself memorable in this movie. You know, we have Chaz Palminteri that's chewing up scenery. You have, Stephen Baldwin is fun in this. How the hell did that happen? Seriously, I want to know. I really want to know how that happened, please. But, I mean, and then, of course, Kevin Pollak. I mean, you know, Kevin Pollak plays a sociopath. He is possibly the most evil of them all, if you really think about it. He is the true evil one. And yet, he's also one of the most interesting because he's got the really cool lines. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about this movie is that it, for me anyway, it definitely hits all of the things that I'm looking for in a movie. And I love the fact that it's one of those that I want to study, but I can also just sit back and just enjoy a really interesting noir film. And I can watch it on that level and just turn my brain off. But yeah, I love this movie. So yeah, it's absolutely a pass. But I think that it's time for us to move away from something fun and talk about something pretty damn serious. What do you think, guys?
Prepare to revisit depression.
Yep, we're doing another sequel to a movie we talked about, but this time it's actually a documentary that we're revisiting. Kent, what do we got up on the list?
We're going back to Southeast Asia, where, fortunately, a lot of people died. Looking at The Look of Silence, which is the follow-up to...
The Act of Killing.
Act of Killing, yeah.
Yeah, I remember that this was a pretty tough one for you. This left a lasting image. So, it'll be interesting to come back to this. Interesting enough that this movie lost to a documentary on Amy Winehouse. So I'm very curious as to how this translates. But, you know, after we get through September, we do have a little month coming up called October. And what does that usually turn us into?
People looking to buy my daughter birthday presents.
Pumpkin spice everything?
Oh, that's funny.
Let's see. October. Germans drinking beer. No. Something to do with, you know.
Yes. You know, crazed clowns, chainsaws, nasty racists. Wait a second. Is this actually like fiction horror? Or are we talking about the last year in politics?
Well, I don't think there were too many chainsaws in last year in politics, but allegations that the dead were rising and they were voting. So, okay.
You just stole my thunder. You stole my That's Thank okay. You. You can take it. But yes, Art House of Horror returns, and we've got ourselves a killer lineup.
A few killers.
Kent, why don't you write us down what we got for this year?
I know we're doing the classic Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Original Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
R.I.P. Toby Hooper.
Original Night of the Living Dead.
R.I.P. George Romero. Okay.
Stop R.I.P.ing right there. And, not sure. What else?
Green Room
is what we just
R.I.P. Anton Yelchin.
That's why I didn't want to go on.
Believe it or not, I'll tell you, with the exception of Anton Yelchin, we literally came up with this list before they died. I swear it. We came up with this list. It's like as soon as we listed them, they keeled over. It's crazy.
If next year you would like us not to list your movie and to avoid your own death, please deposit. No.
It could be worse, you know, in Green Room, it couldn't have been Anton, it could have been someone else.
Don't even say it. Don't even. Anton was bad enough. We're not even implying anybody else.
At least you're not saying his name.
No. So.
Chris, do you want to take responsibility for killing a beloved icon?
Imogen Poots?
All right, we're going to stop this before we get killed. This is the movie.
We're getting silly. Yes.
Right, this is the movie, dude, Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And Fee.